All right. I believe we got it. I think they were turning it up to compensate for the low battery. Do we need to adjust that? Okay. We're speaking this evening about my favorite subject, the rocks. And not just rocks in general. We're talking specifically about the sedimentary rocks, that is, the rocks laid down by water. What a lot of people don't realize is that there are rocks, on the average, about a mile and a half thick, covering all of the continents, and that these rocks are laid down by water. They're laid down horizontally, as would happen in what? In a flood. Layer after layer after layer, average of a mile and a half, that covers all of the continents. Well, we have different ways of looking at that. The evolutionists say, well, this is what built up over millions of years, slowly and gradually. And if you were here last night, what we learned about the rocks just makes that foolishness. Rocks don't form that way. There's a much more reasonable explanation for all of the evidence. I think it's a rapid, high-energy, catastrophic flood that formed this mile and a half of sedimentary rock that then left the graveyard with billions and billions of dead things in it that we're living on today. And that's a pretty good description of what we're living on top of. Rocks laid down by water with billions and billions of dead things in it all over the world. How do we explain that? Two different models. The evolutionist defines it this way. He says this represents what you find when you dig down in the rock. This geologic column, which you see in all your biology and geology textbooks, beginning with the simple animals gradually coming upward. And this is supposed to be what's recorded in the rocks like a tape recorder, recorded some 500,000 years of evolutionary progression. One major problem with this is that you can't dig down in the rocks and find it anywhere. I think that's a pretty significant problem. If you're going to represent it in the textbooks as here's the what you find when you dig down in the rocks, it doesn't exist anywhere. If it did all together in one place, it'd be about 150 miles high, and we're looking at a mile and a half on the average. Sometimes up to 5 miles, obviously, not the whole thing anywhere. But it's pieced together. But it's supposed to be a recording of this slow, gradual progression over millions of years, but it's found in the textbooks. Now, we do have a general order. When one is on top of the other, when you find two or three of these in one place, it's somewhat in this order for a reason that we'll be talking about later. But not, I believe, because of millions of years of progression of evolution. But how do you get this kind of perfect ordered sequence that you see in the textbooks if you don't find it anywhere on the earth? Well, it's built, it's pieced together by a process called correlation. Notice the statement from physical geology by Leighton Judson. Because we cannot find sedimentary rocks representing all of Earth time neatly in one convenient area. Now, that's what this represents. We cannot find that. Because we cannot, he says, we must piece together the rock sequence from locality to locality. So some of it's from China, and some of it's from Texas, and it's pieced together. This process of tying one rock sequence in one place to another in some other place is known as correlation. It's co-related. But now, how do you know what goes where? Well, to somewhat oversimplify it, if you're an evolutionist, you know the simple ones go where? On the bottom. And the more complex ones are correlated on the top. We see some obvious circular logic here, but notice the statement in Encyclopedia Britannica. The end product of correlation is a mental abstraction called the geologic column. The main point we need to get across after we've seen this in the textbook as if it's concrete in stone. No, it's a mental abstraction. that is constructed. It is useful, as we'll see, but not as proof. Notice the statement made by R.H. Rastel of Cambridge University, which explains more of how this happens. He says, it cannot be denied that geologists are here arguing in a circle. He says, the succession of organisms has been determined by a study of their remains embedded in the rocks. And the relative ages of the rocks are determined by the organisms they contain. Now, this is not proving, and it's often used as proof inappropriately. But let me, again, oversimplify, but illustrate what they're saying. Here we have a primitive fossil. How do you know this is a primitive fossil? Well, it's found in an old rock. All right, I can understand that. But how do you know this is an old rock? Well, it's got a primitive fossil in it, you see. You see how that works? And round and round you go. Well, that's what he's acknowledging. Not proving anything. Another problem is the fact that what we see represented here is mostly vertebrates, animals with backbones. They're impressive and they leave a very strong impression in the mind. But that's almost non-existent, in relatively speaking. It's skewed in that direction. 95% of all of the fossils in the fossil record are of marine invertebrates, which is not what you see for the most part in that column. And then there's 4.5% of the rest that are plants and algae. And we have about 1/100th of 1% that are vertebrates, which is most of what you see represented in the column. Most of those are fish. I think there are good reasons for that. But why is it that you don't have pictures mostly of marine invertebrates, which is what you've got in the fossil record for the most part? Well, somebody might get the impression that this is a flood deposit, and you wouldn't want to give the kids that impression. I think that's a very obvious impression, and the founders of the discipline of geology believe that that's exactly what they were looking at. In the textbook Evolution of the Earth, used in most universities today to teach geology, undergraduate, we read of the father of modern stratigraphy, Nicholas Steno, who's one of the heroes. You have to memorize his 12 axioms or you're not going to graduate, that is, you're not going to pass stratigraphy. But Dott and Batten are two of the most representative geologists at the time this was written. Dott was president of the American Geological Association. They acknowledge Steno's axioms provide the ultimate basis of practically all interpretation of Earth history, so their importance can hardly be overemphasized. He taught us how to interpret the strata. What they don't tell you about him is that he wrote this book. It was on display in the Trinity Library at Cambridge when I was doing research there, dedicated to the proof of the Noachian deluge. That's where he was coming from, and that's his explanation of the fossil record. In fact, it was finally acknowledged in Geology 2006 for the first time that I'd ever seen. I had been challenged on this point for 20 years since I found it in Cambridge. Steno believed in the universal flood throughout his life. That's his interpretation of it. Based on that concept, the book, The Genesis Flood, was pretty much the impetus for the modern creation movement, published in 61 by Whitcomb and Morris. The foreword was written by John C. McCampbell, professor, head of the Department of Geology at the University of Southeastern Louisiana, and a thoroughgoing evolutionary geologist, but very fair in his foreword. He acknowledged that the facts of geology fit. Often we hear people saying, well, if you know anything about the rocks, you know this concept will not fit what we see. Well, this very famous geologist says the opposite. The facts do fit, and he says they build a very strong case for this interpretation and a very serious challenge to the uniformitarian gradual process of evolution explanation. Now, he didn't say, as I might, that their view doesn't fit very well and our view does, but he came pretty close to that. One of the questions that we always get when we approach this, especially when people are not familiar with the concept, how in the world do you get all enough water to cover the mountains? There's not enough water to do that. You don't get extra water out of nothing. Well, we need to understand, as Jack Cousteau acknowledges, and he's one that most people understand, knows a lot about the ocean, that if the Earth's crust were to be leveled out, which of course is not the case, but if it were evened out, no land would show above the surface of the sea. The Earth would be covered by a uniform sheet of water more than 10,000 feet deep. Now, it wasn't perfectly level, like a ball bearing. If it were, about 2 miles of water. I think it was maybe a mile deep. The ocean's a mile deep. The mountain's a mile high. And certainly would be enough water to cover it. It's much more relief today, as we'll see. Where did the water go? Okay, it covered the mountains. I think part of it came from above, from the waters above the firmament. Part of it came from subterranean reservoirs. We don't have time to go into that model in detail. But notice the statement from Psalm 104, which we use here as a definition of our model, that we can then test to see if it fits. He's referring to the flood when he said, "You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters were standing above the mountains." When did that happen? During the flood. Okay. "At your rebuke they fled. At the sound of your thunder they hurried away. The mountains rose and the valleys," or literally basins, "sank down." So here you've got greater relief. Mountains rose, ocean basins sank down. I think this was the general picture, this crude diagram, before the flood, a mile deep oceans, a mile high mountains. The waters were above the mountains during the flood. Then at your rebuke they fled, the mountains rose, and the valleys sank down. So that now then, over 70% of the earth's surface, you've got 3 mile deep oceans. That'll hold a lot more water, won't it? Which is the condition today, and you have higher mountains. So we have an explanation for where it came from and where it went, and it all fits perfectly. When the waters covered the oceans, they buried the world that had been destroyed, as was designed by God, the flood to destroy the world that then was. And they buried things, basically, or it buried things, basically, where they lived. It would bury organisms not all mixed up together because they didn't all live in the same place where they lived. As the flood waters rose, the things at the bottom of the ocean would be buried first, and then other. Now, you don't find all of that in one place. But if you do find sharks and lions, typically the sharks are going to be lower, aren't they? And you find sharks, and then you find trilobites that lived on the bottom of the deep ocean. That's typically going to be lower, even than the sharks. So a general order would be predicted based on ecology, based on where they lived, separated not because they lived millions of years apart, but because they lived in different places. We don't expect to see lions running around out here, do we? Not because they've been gone for millions of years, they just live in a different place. And so ecological zones are preserved in the rock, which is exactly what a worldwide flood would be predicted to do. So when we look at the geological time scale that you see in the textbooks, you're looking at something first that is arranged. It's a mental construct. It is skewed to give the impression of these large animals, which almost don't exist, relatively speaking. It's a conceptual correlation, and since it's based on circular logic, it's useless as proof. Now, that doesn't mean it's useless. It is useful as a model. And that's the proper use of this geologic column, where you begin with the thing to be proved, the assumption, and then you test it by looking at the real world and see if the facts fit. And that's the appropriate use of this, and that's the way we're going to be using it. Well, how do you test this? Look at the real world to see if the facts fit. I think Stephen Stanley of Johns Hopkins University provides the basic idea. We'll look at a fuller rendition of his quote before we finish this evening. But of course, he's a thoroughgoing evolutionist. He refers to what he calls topsy-turvy fossils. He says they would disprove evolution. Any topsy-turvy sequence of fossils would force us to rethink our theory. If you got something that's supposed to be down at the bottom that you find up at the top, or at the top down at the bottom, it's not in order. This contradicts the predicted find, and so the topsy-turvy fossils would test. Well, we find that kind of thing all the time. Things that are supposed to be at the bottom that are still alive, called living fossils. Niles Eldridge, curator of the American Museum of Natural History, professor at Columbia, wrote the book Living Fossils, where he documents hundreds of examples, and he says there seems to have been almost no change in any part we can compare. Some of them are right down at the bottom of the column, and no change, and they're still alive. Well, how do we explain that? He says, well, we can't. But there's so many of them, it's just common, and they don't really think that much about it, even though they can't explain it. I think it's a challenge, a serious challenge. Maybe the most famous example is the coelacanth, a fish that you know if you're used to looking at dinosaur fossils. Here we see Keith Thompson, who was at this time president of the Academy of Natural Sciences, wrote the book Living Fossil about the coelacanth primarily. In it, he says, this is a fish thought to be extinct for 70 million years. Why? Well, because you find it here on this column, and that belongs here with the dinosaurs, and you don't find any of them up above that. Well, that means it went extinct, right? Unless this is a record of what happened catastrophically in a year's flood deposit, and then that would just mean they lived here, they didn't live up here, but it wouldn't necessarily mean they went extinct. But for 70 million years, according to the geologic column, you find none. He says they look quite like what? We got them alive today. Now, we didn't know about it until about the late 30s, early 40s. And there are no fossils younger than the late Cretaceous. That's where the dinosaurs are. And the same evidence for extinction of them that we find with the dinosaurs, but none since then, but they're just, we've caught well over 1,000 of them since they were first found back in the early 40s. And there are hundreds of examples of those. This is what we'll call the topsy fossils that are supposed to be down that are found up top. The obvious implication is it falsifies the idea that because you don't find it above a certain point, it went extinct. Not so. We prove that it's not so. We prove that it's not so hundreds of times. And they still parrot the idea. I think it's falsified. But the real evidence that would totally falsify is the opposite, though both are devastating, I think. What's supposed to be up, found down. Now, they hadn't evolved yet down at the bottom, and so how could you find these things supposed to be at the top down? That would just rip it, wouldn't it? We'll call that the turvy fossils. And notice the implication from Richard Dawkins, one of the more famous anti-creationists. He says, we should be very surprised, for example, to find fossil humans appearing in the record before mammals are supposed to evolve. They should be up here, not down here. He says, if a single well-verified mammal skull were to turn up in 500 million-year-old rocks, our whole modern theory of evolution would be utterly destroyed. Here's the test. Let's compare this model, this mental abstraction, with the real world, and if we find this, we got problems with the model, don't we? In Newsweek, fairly recently, he said not a single solitary fossil has ever been found before it could have evolved. In other words, they're all in order. Well, before we finish tonight, you'll be able to evaluate that statement. It ain't so. And it won't be so, though. I mean, he won't see it because he's made up his mind it's not so, and he, no matter how much you show him, he won't see it. if that sounds brash, well, just wait and we'll show you. Evolution could so easily be disproved if just a single fossil turned up in the wrong date order. Remember that statement. Let's see if we find a single fossil in the wrong. We find this kind of thing all the time. One of the most obvious of what he's talking about, here are human fossils down with the dinosaurs way 100 million years before they're supposed to have evolved. Near La Salle, Utah. Perfectly modern skeletons. This is in the Dakota Sandstone. That's one of the layers that's found at Dinosaur National Monument in the Dakota Sandstone. Well, how do you explain that? Well, they must have fallen down a crack. Well, where's the crack and what's the evidence? Well, you don't have to have any evidence. We know they lived long after the dinosaurs did. You have to have. You see. They crawled back in the cave and it collapsed. It's a mine cave in. Well, where's the evidence of that? We've now found 9 individuals at this site. 4 of them are women. 1 of them is an infant, and there are no tools. A mine cave-in, no broken bones. Mine cave-in, no broken bones. About half of them are females, an infant, and no tools. Does that sound like a mine cave-in? They're just washed into place. We went back to the site to see if we could verify this, and it's an open-pit copper mine near La Salle, Utah, and these skeletons were found 50 feet down in the Dakota Sandstone. Now, this one is somewhat articulated. Most of them are just washed into place. We see the pelvis over here on the right and the knee up top and the foot down in the lower left with the other leg behind it. They're replaced with malachite, as we'll see. These bones may appear to be belong together. Actually, they're just washed into place. We see 2 individuals there on the right. I just excavated this femur and washed it off with the canteen. Bright green, they are replaced almost completely, some of them, with malachite. And so this is not a recent burial. It takes maybe 1,000 years. There's no collagen. It takes roughly 1,000 years for that to gradually dissipate in, under normal circumstances. If you want a quick and dirty way to tell if you got a fossil or a bone, you take a match and you light the end of it, and if it stinks, you got collagen in it. That's fresh bone. If it doesn't, no collagen, that's probably 1,000 years old. We did much more than that. We did the scanning electron microscope to show there was absolutely no collagen. This is an excellent turvy fossil that Dawkins says would utterly destroy evolution, except he just won't accept it. Couldn't be, and won't see it. He goes on in that context to say, ironically, it's also the reason why creationists are so keen on the fake human footprints which were carved during the Depression to fool tourists in the dinosaur beds of Texas. Well, he's heard about our work all the way from Oxford. He won't come look at them. But he's sure that they're fake, and they have to be because dinosaurs and humans are 100 million years apart. Well, why are we so interested in the footprints? I mean, wouldn't bones be better evidence? Not really, because it is possible to erode bones and redeposit them. They can be intrusionally buried, and if you find them in the wrong place, guess what? They are. Don't have to prove it, they just are. You know that, they're in the wrong place. But you can't do that with footprints, can you? You can't erode them and redeposit them. They're gone. They are where they are, in situ, as we say. Let's go to Dinosaur Valley State Park, which is the site he had reference to, where we find literally thousands of dinosaur tracks. Really spectacular to sit there and imagine these giant, awesome creatures as they lumbered across the landscape. Here the three-toed, the sauropod, quadrupeds, the just spectacular displays of dinosaur tracks. Some of them are three-dimensionally raised, as you can see here. How did that happen? Well, it left the depressed track. They filled in with other material, which became hard and actually harder than the surrounding material, so that when they are subsequently exposed, erosion began to erode away what's around it and leave the raised infill. And we see this rather significantly, as we'll notice, in some of the tracks that look a little different, like this. Can anybody imagine what that might be? I think we've got a pretty good idea of what that looks like. But this is what he had reference to. This has to be carved. And I was somewhat intimidated by that, because it's just almost too good to be true. So we looked around to try to find some that weren't quite that good, and we were able to do that as well. This one was found by Dr. John Morris, which looks pretty impressive, like a human track, but it was a single track. You really need a sequence in order to have good evidence. Stan Taylor in the early 70s found several tracks that were coming out from the bank into the river and decided to follow the trail back up under the riverbank. Now, if they do continue under these alternating layers of clay and limestone and clay and limestone, about 6 feet of this, if they continued back up under the bank, what would that say about the idea they were carved? That'd pretty well rip it, wouldn't it? Well, he found 12 in a right-left pattern going back up under the riverbank, and some of them very obvious mud push-up around it and a very obvious human shape. People got excited about it. Glenn Kuban, though, thought that he answered this. In fact, he got Humanist of the Year for answering this, which will tell you how excited some of the evolutionists had been about this argument. He says, look, this duck-looking track, dinosaur track, erodes to look like the one beside it. But then these elongate tracks erode to look like, kind of like a human track, you see. And so what we're looking at is just eroded dinosaur tracks. Well, one of the problems with that is that when we see many of the tracks that have this infill, which is harder, erosion simply makes it more pronounced. The track sticks out, whereas the matrix erodes away from it. From the side, you can see that happening here, and it becomes more defined and more obvious. That's not going to erode to look like a human track, is it? It gets more pronounced. And some of the tracks are so detailed. Does that look like an eroded dinosaur track? Is that a good explanation? That's just not going to fly, especially when you put a human foot into it and it fits and it's just molded. This is a cast that Stan Taylor made that I have in my office. We did extend Stan Taylor's trail for several more tracks. This was newly exposed that I helped expose, and I was trying to play the devil's advocate. How do you explain this away? And you have to look at that a minute for it to sink in. Here is the dinosaur track. It's about 25 inches, I'm sorry. About a 25-inch dinosaur track. But look what stepped in the middle of it. You see all five toes and instep and heel very dramatically within the dinosaur track. Now, sometimes you find human tracks outside and across and within. There are about 100 dinosaur tracks on this platform, with the trail of human tracks going right through the middle of them. Glenn Kuban didn't like this, and this is what he did to it. He heard me present for the first time at a university up in Tennessee this evidence. In fact, I believe Lawton was there at the presentation. He went berserk and got on a plane the next day, was in the river with an iron bar, and beat the living daylights out of it. We had 4 witnesses that saw it. But there are more evidence, and of course we had it well documented. We had cast and stereo photographs, and he just showed, I think, how significant it was. Up ahead, not directly, but another example ahead, is this track, And notice the three-toed dinosaur track in the anterior portion up near the front, but then again, something stepped in the back of it. The dinosaur tracks are sometimes raised. We look at a side view of that same track, and you see almost flush here the dinosaur toes, and perhaps with more erosion, they'll be slightly raised. But the depression is a different shape, isn't it? And came at a different time. He stepped within the infill after the dinosaur stepped, and then the material filled in. Putting a human foot in it, again, it's just you can feel that molded shape. And it's very persuasive. Now, again, playing the devil's advocate. All right, this—if this is really a sequence of human tracks, then you ought to have a right here, and directly ahead of it, you should have a left, shouldn't you? All right, this is a right. Directly ahead of it, you have a left, and it's left, right, for at least 14 that we can distinguish. Looking at a side view of that one, you see the dinosaur track here is completely outside. It's beside the human track. The human track should be consistent in length as well as alternating rights and lefts, which is exactly what we see as demonstrated in this photograph. Now, the dinosaur trail is coming across. There are many more dinosaur tracks that we don't have highlighted, but the human trail goes right, left, for, in this case, 14. We have uncovered a few more. Now, the value of the sequence is you can see lots of funny-looking things in rocks that just happen to look like things. You look up in the sky, and, yeah, there's a bird, okay? You look at the old man in the mountain on the side of the cliff here. How can you tell the difference? How do you know whether this is erosion or if it were carved? Well, if you look at the mountain and you see four old men in the mountain, you got a pretty good idea, right? We see 14, right, left for 14, with, in many cases, all five toes and instep and heel. That becomes very, very good evidence. And this is the way you do science. Now, Dawkins can sit behind his desk and know that these are out of place and therefore can't be, and we get out and do the science. There are 14 of them, and the highest one is plus one, and then they go in either direction from there. All of them have at least a general human shape. They're very consistent in length, more so than the dinosaur tracks, some of which are still being revealed by erosion. You can see clear toes in seven of them. We've showed you, of course, the most dramatic ones. Most fossil footprints, you cannot see individual toes. Mary Leakey's over in Africa, some of you may be familiar with. You can't see, well, you can see the great toe in several of them, but no individual toes. Here, seven of them are with good toes. You can distinguish right from left in all but two, 12 of the 14. Now, this was confirmed by a double-blind test at Kansas State University with the psych department where we showed them life-size photographs. First question, just laid the photographs out on the table, what are these? And 97.5% said these are human footprints. Okay, now we get rough on these college students. Tell us whether they're rights or lefts. And there was an 84% correspondence to what we had predicted. None of them were consistently different. But since you say, all right, two of them you can't tell, that was about the percentage, almost exactly the percentage that we had predicted. When Glenn Kuban lectures on this subject, guess which two footprints he shows you? The two that you can't distinguish. The rest he just ignores. But they are consistent in right, left sequence. This is the way you do science. And it is just very, very persuasive science, I think. I think these are perfect turvy fossils. They cannot be intrusionally buried like bones. You can't do that with footprints. They can't be carved. They were excavated from under the overburden, about 6 feet of overburden. Not erosion, because you got a right, left pattern for 14, better than the four men in the mountain. that just really answers the objections. And so I really enjoy presenting this on college campuses. It gets to be fun. I was lecturing at State University in Tennessee with a group of grad students. Head of the department was there, finished, and they all turned around to ask him, you know, what do we say about this? And he said, well, we don't know that there weren't dinosaurs back there with human feet. And I thought a minute. I said, well, I guess that's right. It could have been dinosaurs with human feet. We also don't know there weren't humans back there with dinosaur feet. Wouldn't that make about as much sense? Wouldn't it make more sense to say these things that look like dinosaur feet were made by dinosaurs, and these things look like human feet were made by humans? And no, he wouldn't agree with that. I said, well, if they were made by humans, would they look any different? And he got up and left. But that's his explanation, the dinosaurs with human feet. Dr. Chuck Finsley was curator of the Dallas Museum of Natural History for 30 years. He had just retired and was down trying to get one of the dinosaurs that we had excavated in the area, an Acrocanthosaurus, and we made him look at the footprints. And he got upset and left. And then about a month later, he came back, and he had to look at the footprints again. He got upset and left again. Third time he came down, he said, Dr. Patton, I've got an answer. I know what these things that look like human footprints are. He says, I think they were made by aliens. And I kind of laughed, and he got mad. I said, Chuck, if they came from a galaxy far, far away, they'd be more advanced than we are. You know, what are they doing running around barefooted? And he didn't like that either. But these are the scientific answers, and it's about the best they can do. Now, maybe the best sounding answer, it's not really an answer at all. They say, well, you need more evidence. That's easy. You know, it's a cop-out, but that's 14 in a right-left pattern. Okay, in 2000, there was a huge drought in the area, and we decided to follow this trail back down the river, pumping the river dry. Now, that's a pretty good trick. The farmers liked us because we were pumping water on their fields, though we were praying more for more drought, and they were praying for rain. We won for a while. We extended that trail for the longest consecutive dinosaur trail on the American continent. A lot of work excavating there, about 2 months worth. And see the little man right up here? That's not the end of the trail. It goes on, he's pointing around the corner to over 500 consecutive feet of dinosaurs. And they are some of the most spectacular dinosaur tracks in the world, just beautifully preserved. And the longest on the American, second longest in the world. We know what dinosaur tracks look like. We've excavated and, we know all about it. Nothing that looks anything like a human track here until you get up on the far end of it and it crosses this trail of 14 very human-like tracks. Well, we published this, and then guess what they said? Well, you need more evidence, which is about all you could say. And we thought, okay, we see this fellow headed toward the platform up above, and we had to remove two or three layers to get down to the print layer. But we excavated that platform, and there was almost 100 dinosaur tracks on that platform. And sure enough, there's another trail of human-like tracks going right through the middle of it, a different individual. This one, instead of 11 and a half, was averaging 10 consistently. Looking at the center of that trail, we see two dinosaur tracks. These are the duck-like tracks that are fairly typical in the area. And they're slightly raised, especially the one on the left. The one on the right is the mate that's matched and slightly raised. But look what stepped in the one on the right. Not like that duck shape at all that dramatically is defined, especially on the one on the left. Strong mud push-up, and then looking at a close-up of that track, you can see the raised dinosaur track, and then, wow, you just don't get better than that. You can actually see the knuckles in the toes. And that's in a sequence of 15 in a right-left pattern. Many of the others are very good as well. More, you know, they don't say you need more evidence now. They just shut up. I think it's excellent evidence. With the confidence that we had from that, we went back to this one that Dawkins was sure was carved, that I was somewhat intent, because, I mean, that really looks good. How can you tell whether it's carved or not? We did find exactly where it came from, not too far from this site where we had been excavating. We sectioned across the heel. Sometimes down under the track, you can see evidence of the original impression. Look at the disturbed material directly under the heel. Mm-hmm. This doesn't look like a carved track. A carved track would cut across structures rather than leaving following contours. So when we did that, let me back that up. When we did this, we presented it at a science meeting there in Dallas, and the response was, finally, I mean, it was kind of quiet for a while. They said, well, you obviously have a real track, but it must be a dinosaur track someone carved toes on. So completely ad hoc, but okay, I'm glad they did that, because we proceeded to section across the toes, which is a real reach. Sometimes you section dinosaur tracks, you find nothing. And you just have to get lucky to have that kind of preservation. But sectioning here across the toes, photographed under black light and then color corrected, you can see the structure better. Here is the great toe. And actually, you can see load-bearing structures under each of the toes. Engineers can lecture from this. You can see better load-bearing structures than you have in the textbook in many instances. But especially here at the great toe, the following contours show this is not carved. And so both at heel and toe, we see this one verified. But then it just really got good. In 2000, we found, a friend of ours, amateur archaeologist Alvin Delp, found this one. Now, he didn't see the human part for another 2 years because he hadn't removed the clay. He saw the dinosaur track, took it home, stuck it under his bed. Needed some money, so he thought maybe he could sell it, and then washed it off, and wow, look at what's in the front of it. Now, that's way too good to be true, right? Well, how do you tell? Well, sometimes you can see the structures underneath. We did the spiral CAT scan in 2008, and the scan went right across where the white line is, and you can see the slice up above it. Here's where the dinosaur toe is, and here's where the human toe is. But look under the human toe. The following contours down in the rock show that that's not carved. Carving wouldn't do that. It's verified as well by the CAT scan. How do you say they're 100 million years apart if they're stepping in each other's footprints? You go out here and look at the sidewalk, and here are two footprints people had left while the sidewalk was hardening, and you say this one was made 50 years after that one. You gonna buy that? I don't think so. In order to be preserved, this would have to be hardened rapidly, as we pointed out last evening. This is not the only place where you find such tracks. Here in New Mexico, in the Permian, which is supposed to be 100 million years older, is a spectacular track. It looks better than it looks when person here in this photograph. You have to get the right angle of the sun. It has to be wet. It's an extremely shallow track. And we've learned a lot about tracks. When you're walking, you leave one kind. When you're running, you leave another kind. When you have a hard matrix, like when you're walking with a wet foot on a tile floor, you leave this kind of a track, the hourglass with the little dots at the end. This one didn't sink in. It's almost like that foot on the tile floor, and almost just very difficult to photograph. When you do, it stands out very well, but extremely hard limestone. There are four more in the area just like that in perfect sequence. All the way to Turkmenistan, we have a plain covered with dinosaur tracks. Here from Pravda, we have a description from the headlines: human footprints found on dinosaurs plateau. The Turkmenian plateau contains more than 3,000 footprints, but among the most mysterious fact is among the footprints of dinosaurs, footprints of bare human feet were found. He continues, because we know humans evolved much later, it was an extraterrestrial that walked in his swimsuit on the ancient seashore. That's the way they explain it. I guess you can imagine that and call that science. And so Dr. Finsley, not by himself. There's a lot of it's just dishonesty to not face the facts like that. One of the most obvious examples happened a good while ago, back in 1940. This was reported in Scientific American. A claim had been made there something looked like human footprints here in the Carboniferous. That's way down in the column, way before humans are supposed to be there. And they accompanied that article with this picture. And wow, you say, that's not a human footprint, obviously. That's nuts. Anybody that think that's a human footprint's crazy, right? And I thought that because that's what Scientific American said they looked like. I'd heard about them. In the article, they say, if a man existed as far back as the Carboniferous period in any shape, then the whole science of geology is so completely wrong that all the geologists will resign their jobs and take up truck driving. And in terms of their teaching, that would be the implication if you found them together. And so, no, this is not what that is. Hence, for the present, at least, science rejects the attractive explanation that man made these mysterious prints in the mud. You have to. Except that's not what was at Berea, Kentucky. They lied about it. These were drawings from an Indian site 30 miles away and had absolutely nothing to do with what's at Berea, Kentucky, which looks very much like human footprints. These are two of eight tracks that look very human. You can see the raised mud push up around them. Now, they've been eroding since 1940. But still very pronounced. You can discern the concentrated sand grains under the pressure points. That test was done by the geology professor nearby. I think we see good evidence that that's been verified and that Scientific American was just lying, intentionally deceiving, telling people they look like this. And maybe they need to take up truck driving. I'm not so sure I want them on the road either. We move from there to Natural Bridges National Monument out in the Four Corners area. A beautiful site where the Anasazi Indians drew the petroglyphs on the rocks. And here's Dr. Swift pointing up there toward the era where we have a number of sheltered drawings. And here on this shelf are the Anasazi petroglyphs. Above my head, you see the warrior, you see the snakes, which they worship, but look beside me there. It's very difficult to photograph because of the heavy desert varnish, which also indicates these are not modern. Of course, the Anasazi disappeared some 1,200 years ago. They were drawing pictures of dinosaurs, and I don't think there's a whole lot of question about that. Even the rock artist experts like Barnes, who's written over 100 books on rock art, said there's a petroglyph in Natural Bridges National Monument that bears a startling resemblance to a dinosaur, specifically a brontosaurus, with a long tail, neck, small. How were the Indians drawing pictures of that? I was asking the curator of the Price Museum nearby, Price, Utah. He said, well, I've seen that, and I've seen several others like that in other places. Maybe they were smoking the Paiute and had a 65-million-year-old dream. Now, actually, he said they just got drunk and dreamed it up. That happened to be just like that 65-million-year-old dinosaur. Okay. Let's go to Peru. spectacular area where we could lecture for the rest all week. But we'll look particularly at the work of Javier Cabrera, who was 20 years head of the Department of Medicine at the University of Lima, established the first teaching medical hospital there in Peru, performed the first heart transplant there, and then retired to be cultural anthropologist for the area of Inca. His dad, back in the 30s, began collecting burial stones from the Inca tombs, and we were able to get into some of the tombs and help with some of the excavations. And interestingly, in these tombs, you have the stones, the burial stones, which he'd been collecting. In his collection, he has over 11,000 of these stones with very interesting carvings. They go back to at least 1,500 to 2,500 years ago. And this is an example of them. 2,500 years ago, 2,000 years ago, they were drawing pictures of dinosaurs. We're supposed to have known what they looked like 150 years ago. We had a very poor idea. We didn't know that Brontosaurus had those frills until they were reported in Geology magazine in 1990, when Mr. Sinclair drew his dinosaur. He didn't draw them with the dermal frills that you see there that they knew about. Some of them are large and very ornate and artistically done. You see the dinosaur with the dermal frills. Another one on the other side, notice in the upper right-hand corner, shades of Jurassic Park there with the fellow's foot in his mouth. Some crudely done, almost cartoonish, and some very elaborately done. Some look almost oriental. They're still being excavated from the tombs. We helped excavate this one in 2006. Dr. Cabrera passed away in 2002, and he's supposed to have excavated all 11,000, according to the skeptics, for some strange reason. Not excavated, supposed to have carved them himself. That's crazy. We also find burial cloths with the dinosaur motifs in the tombs, and we see it on the pottery. These are the Moshe vases, well over 1,000 years old. And then in upper part of, this one is from the National Museum there in Lima, circa 2,500 years, it says there at the museum. The northern part of Peru, we have the gold death masks, and look on either side of the face with the dermal frills on the back, the long tail curled up, and the big teeth with the dinosaur. We see the people in Peru had to see dinosaurs 2,000 years ago. Travel with me to Mexico, Central Highlands, state of Guanajuato, the city of Acámbaro, a beautiful colonial city. We traveled there with Dr. Swift, an archaeologist. We made over 6 trips over a period of 5 years. And we were investigating the Jules Rudd collection, which was collected mostly back in the early 1900s and then hidden away because he found some things that weren't supposed to be found. Some rather bizarre creatures, as you can see. Over 30,000 figurines, and about 10% of them are of dinosaurs. Thermoluminescent dating as well as cultural dating put them at about 4,000 years old. Well, over 2,000 dinosaurs over 4,000 years ago. That doesn't fit much what's in the textbook, does it? Definitely a turvy fossil. Some of the brontosaurus were seen standing up. We didn't know that till Spielberg taught us that. Actually, Bakker taught him about 15 years ago, and then Spielberg convinced us all that they could stand up. But a wide variety of species. Again, some almost cartoony, some of them very literal and rather artistic. This is my wife's favorite. But the obvious implication is that man and dinosaur live together. 2,000 examples of these. Now, let's travel to France. If it's in France, people have been there a long time. They ought to have known about it, but they walk over them all the time. Examples, as we'll see. You go to the Louvre. Anybody been to the Louvre? I mean, thousands of people all the time. And right there in the Louvre, you see Sir George fighting the dragon, but look what that dragon looks like. What does that look like to you? Somebody stuck wings on him, but that's a T-Rex. How would they do that back in the 1400s? Had no idea what dinosaurs looked like, we're told. We travel down toward the south of France, the beautiful Chateau de Chambord. I don't normally take my wife on some of these harrowing trips, but Paris, she gets to go. This was built by Francis I in the 14th century. It has dinosaurs carved all over it. Looking at a close-up here, you see the obvious scales and claws of the reptilian creatures on the ceiling and on the walls. Over 700 dinosaurs can be seen. This is supposed to be a hunting lodge. What were they hunting? The theme is obviously dinosaurs. Compare that with the plateosaurus. We're familiar with the T-Rex and, you know, the long neck, the brontosaurus. Not so familiar with some of the others. The plateosaurus is a dead ringer for what you see all over these castle walls. You see numerous examples with some variation, but they all look like the plateosaurus. I mean, dead ringers. And not too far away, less than 20 miles, you see the Chateau de Blois. Beautiful castle. This is where Joan of Arc went to receive her blessing and began to be built in the 12th century, and there are dinosaurs all over it. You go inside, you look at the throne room. Here's a beautiful tapestry from the 14th century. And what are we looking at here? Looking at a close-up. Notice the discovery that was revealed in 2007 at the Vertebrate Paleontology Annual Meeting there in Austin with Bob Bakker, who had found Dracorex hogwartia. You Harry Potter fans would recognize that. This is looks like a dragon. It's a dinosaur head. And when you compare that with what you see on the tapestry, wow, that's a dead ringer, isn't it? The dragon or dinosaur. And then the little juvenile hadrosaur on the same tapestry is just identical to what you see in the standard dinosaur textbooks on the tapestry from the 14th century. How did they do that? Well, I think they had to be seeing them. And so in France, whether you're at Chateau de Chambord or Chateau de Blois, you see evidence of this all over the place. You can find several of them on the building of the Louvre as well. Now, let's go to Cambodia. Wives don't get to go here. This is a communist dictatorship and still some dangerous circumstances. But up in the north part of Cambodia, there's some of the most spectacular temples in the world. The largest, the biggest, maybe the prettiest that were ever built anywhere. The Khmer Empire. We know quite a bit about them. One of the greatest monument builders was Jayavardhan VII that we see pictured here, almost in the Buddha pose, in the photograph I took there at Phnom Penh. He began to rule in 1181, and of course knew all about dinosaurs, did they? Well, this is one of the temples that he built to Prom, dedicated to his mother, that was built in 1186. It's been left natural, unreclaimed from the jungle, and almost every square inch of these temple walls are covered by carvings. And under this huge monumental structure, you see a column, the two columns there, the dancing girls, Hindu girls on the left, and then the animals, the deer and the monkeys. And what is that? Looking at a close-up, can you recognize that? This is dedicated in 1186. They were drawing pictures of dinosaurs way, way back there before we're supposed to have known what they looked like. Obviously, more proof of the co-occurrence of humans and dinosaurs. And we don't want anybody making any comments about there being two dinosaurs in that picture, which I heard once. summarizing. What does this mean? What's the significance? In the handouts, you'll have the full context of these quotations, but Louis Jacobs, who at the time was president of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology, professor at SMU, says evolution would be vanquished. S.M. Stanley, that we quoted from earlier, says it would disprove evolution. Jerry Cohn, who is a professor of evolutionary biology at the University of Chicago and a vicious anti-creationist, says this is one of the, that is referring to the human-dinosaur combination, an ugly fact that could kill Darwinism if it were true, which of course he denies. And then Richard Dawkins has had a good bit to say about it, said evolution would be utterly demolished, evolution would be disproved, and in one point he said it would blow the theory of evolution out of the water. I find myself agreeing with him, not very often, but here I think he's absolutely right. That's what it means. It is a test of this model, this mental abstraction that shows the facts do not fit. That's the proper use of this, not as proof based on the circular logic, but as a model to test against the real world. And when we test it against the real world, we see contradiction after contradiction after contradiction, and we've just looked at a few of them. And so that rips the model. That's not a good model. It doesn't fit the facts. These are facts that devastate it. Nova came to Glen Rose, looked at the footprints you looked at. People there were excited. They thought they had earth-shaking evidence. The editor killed it. And then they put out a piece that said there's nothing that looks anything like human footprints at Glen Rose. And if you go to the state park there, they'll tell you that. Nothing looks anything like human footprints. You can decide the nature of that kind of statement. But they put out a brief video called God, Darwin, and the Dinosaurs, referring to the evidence at Glen Rose, and acknowledged why they're making these statements. Dinosaur footprints side by side with humans, finding them would counter evidence that humans evolved long after the dinosaurs became extinct and back up the claim that all species, including man, were created at one time. That's what it means. They know that's what it means. And so they say, no, 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 doesn't exist. Well, you decide for yourself whether or not it exists. If it does, that's what it means, that God spoke this universe into existence and he created those dinosaurs. I love to take the young people down to the river there at Glen Rose, and we walk in the footprints, the human footprints and the dinosaur footprints, and when they put their foot in those tracks and then see right there the dinosaur trails, you're not going to tell that person they're 100 million years apart. It just doesn't work. And they look at these dinosaur tracks, some of them 2 feet wide. And I can see them looking down at it, and then they, in their mind's eye, they look up, and you see the jaw drop, and wow, what an awesome, awesome creature. Anybody here awed by dinosaurs? Let me tell you something. There's something more awesome than the T-Rex, and that's the one who created him. That's the point that God was making to Job when I believe he was talking about the dinosaurs. You're going to complain about God, tell God he's doing things wrong. Why don't you go try telling that to T-Rex? Look at Behemoth, whom I made with you, Leviathan. Go argue with him. You wouldn't do that? Then why would you argue with his creator, who has to be much, much more awesome? Think about it. It is that creator who created T-Rex and the awesome dinosaurs who is inviting you this evening to respond to his invitation and offering you his grace and forgiveness of sin. And how will you respond to him? Can you ignore such a being? When he says, come confessing your faith, repent of your sins, and be baptized into Christ. Nah, I don't think I will. To one who spoke the universe into existence and created the T-Rex, listen to him and submit to him. If you've wandered away, come back while we stand together and sing.